you continue on with training and preparation for the invasion?
Yes, and once that was finished, we were moved to Fareham, north of Portsmouth, and put behind barbed wire there.
The concentration area?
Yes, and we were guarded by British soldiers who were not involved in the invasion, and no one was allowed to leave except our men who, our vehicles had to be kept on the streets in the residential areas, and they were all sworn to secrecy, although they didn't know anything much about it, neither did we. But we officers were finally taken to the 21st Army Group headquarters, where Montgomery was, and even Eisenhower was there. And we were briefed on the invasion, but we still weren't told where it was. It could have been anywhere in Northwest Europe. And then back to our camps. We were issued with French occupation money. But we were locked up by this time. But none of the chaps outside were given the money yet. They were given it when they went aboard. That was the mining craft.
So you had a good idea of where you were going.
Yeah, we're going to France, but where in France, nobody knew. And so we were behind in this camp for a few days, and then we were all formed up into serials. And when the serial number was called, that group would go out to the outside the gate and go aboard their own vehicles and drive down to Boscombe, which is another little seaport beside Portsmouth. And so we go down, and we were loaded upon LCT Mark IV and sailed immediately to Southampton and tied up along several others. Camouflage nets put over the whole works, which smelled as though they'd been in storage for 15 years or more, and almost choked you, but it was to hide what was on board from the German aircraft if they came over, which they did, but they couldn't tell what was on board, and well, they shouldn't have been able to. And we were on board for about 5 days, and in very cramped space, 200 people, and there were two toilets, one of which was stopped up, so that a lot of people became constipated, which just added to the agony. We were allowed off once, and by ship, and we were allowed to use, we were allowed to have a shower, use latrines, and write letters. And those letters were kept there and censored, and then mailed after D-Day. So then on the 5th of June, in the late afternoon, we sailed. Went down past the Isle of Wight, and then we were issued with our orders once we were seaborne.
Why don't you take me through your whole D-Day, what I would have seen if I were in your shoes.
Oh, yes. On the way over, we could see nothing but dark blobs on the water. 5,000 ships, and there were some gunfire, explosions, and so on, a few flares at night, but we were seasick going across, most of us, I was. And so when we were supposed to land after the infantry and fire on going in, which we did, and as we were approaching, a smoke screen was laid, the infantry were landing, and we were firing on a target just inside Bernier-sur-Mer, where we were going to land. And the infantry landed, and we stopped firing and turned around and waited our turn. The whole thing was held up because the water was so terribly rough that all the invasion fleet was delayed by about half an hour to an hour. So we landed a little after 9 o'clock in the morning, and but before we landed, we were being strafed by machine guns on an enfilade from both sides. There were little machine gun nests there. And we were being fired upon from, we found out later, from Le Havre and from guns inland, 88s and other field guns. And we weren't hit, but when we landed, we had some Queen's Own Rifles people on board, including the regimental sergeant major, in one Bren gun carrier, and they went off first down our ramp in about 3 or 4 foot water, And we went off, I went off immediately after in my burndown carrier. And they went off to the left and we went straight ahead. And they ran over a mine or were struck by something. And we heard this terrible explosion. And the explosion forced me over on top of my driver. And he was on the right hand side. And something landed on my leg, on my upper leg. And all this trickling, something was running down my leg. And I thought, oh boy, I've been hit. Blood running down there. So I looked back and here was a jerry can of petrol that had blown out of this Bren gun carrier, landed on me and burst open, and there was petrol. So I threw it out and I said to the driver, "Are you all right?" He said, "Well, if you get off me," I said, "No." And anyway, none of us were hurt. And I said, "Drive forward fast. Let's get out of here." I had looked out and I saw an arm floating away in the water with blood coming out of it and dead bodies, parts of bodies, and the Bren gun carrier upside down with no track on one side. We tried to go forward and the tracks were spinning. So I looked out and here was a great big long log. And so I called to the two signalers in the back of the vehicle to get out. So they jumped out with me and the three of us picked up this huge waterlogged log and put it sideways and drove on. 2 weeks later, the same crew came back to the beach. The log was still there. We tried to lift it up and we couldn't budge it. So heavy. When you have that adrenaline going, you can do almost anything. So when we landed, we were still being strafed, but we were fortunate. We weren't hit. One of our vehicles from the regiment, regimental headquarters, two or three of them were drowned, as they called it. The engines weren't quite waterproof enough, perhaps. So they were stuck in the water. I had to go forward and deploy the guns in the first field. I knew where to go. It was beside an orchard. So we drove through the village and it was on fire. A lot of things were on fire. And we were held up by tanks. They had stopped. And the tank ahead of us, tarpaulin, was on fire. And we were yelling at them, but of course they couldn't hear anything. So somebody jumped out and ran over and beat the fire out and tapped on the officer who was standing in the turret, told him that it was on fire. Anyway, they got it out. Then a woman came over and tears running down her cheeks, an elderly lady who had been hiding in the basement of a building there, gave us a bottle of wine and two fresh eggs. We put away. 2 weeks later, remembered the eggs were there. Mind you, we didn't eat them. And we were even afraid to eat or drink the wine because we were told that it might be poisoned by the Germans or the people who were friendly with the Germans on the coast. Anyway, it was all right later. But we finally moved on into this gun position, and we were deploying the three guns of our battery and one from another battery, because they were all mixed up with the traffic. It was terribly mixed up. And all of a sudden, the sergeants were called to the director to get their orders as to how to lay their guns, what angle to lay their guns on. And the first, there was an explosion, and an 88 up in the hill opened up and hit. Three shots hit three of the tanks, blew them up and killed all the men on board. And each self-propelled gun was loaded with extra ammunition, and ammunition for other weapons such as 9mm pistols and 303 rifles. 9mm mortars, and so on. And all this created a fantastic explosion, of course. And the fourth round hit the Sherman tank we used as a command post vehicle. And bits and pieces wounded a couple of the men there, and they had to be evacuated to England as well because it went in their faces. So we had to evacuate that position immediately, and we moved back towards the beach, not knowing where to go. We found an empty field, went into it. There was a row of Lombardy poplars, and they're very tall trees, so we didn't have much field of fire because we had to fire in the upper register, which is, you have to work out specially special mathematics, in order not to hit the trees and still hit your target. But we gathered almost the whole regiment of guns there, and I went over to one of the guns to see if everything was okay, And I was standing talking to the sergeant and looking beyond the field we were in, and I saw people moving. I looked, and there were Germans in gray uniforms. They were running towards the beach. So I said, "Look, put your 50 millimeter gun on them, quick." So he did. He fired at them, and they ran back to these big humps in the grass that were covered with grass, and they were shelters, of course. So then I went over the beach wall and told the infantry that there were Germans there, and so they went over the wall and captured them. I didn't have any resistance. So we had no problems there except for the difficulty in firing over the trees. But the infantry moved forward so fast that they were out of range of our artillery. So we had to move again. And we moved immediately to a crossroads and immediately came under fire from small arms, from a little wood at a corner called Benny-sur-Mer, where the cemetery is now, big Canadian cemetery. So we were pretty well pinned down there, but we did manage to fire a few rounds in support of the infantry. That night the Germans came over and bombed the beaches and blew up ammunition dumps and missed us again. So we next morning moved to another place called La Mer, and there was where Kurt Meyer was in front of us, and he sent his tanks up to within sight of our guns, and suddenly they turned around and went back. Why? We don't know. We gave what we call tank alert. In other words, there are enemy tanks coming, and you fire special anti-tank ammunition at them. And we loaded to fire at them, but then they weren't quite close enough yet, so we didn't fire. That was a very dangerous position, though, because the Germans were on three sides of us, some of them in a radar sight, which they held for 12 days after D-Day, and we were way beyond it, all the infantry and artillery and everything. But they were firing at us from there, from straight ahead and from our right flank. It was very accurate, so we figured there must be a German observation post nearby. So we saw a farmhouse off to our right. So I looked at the farmhouse in binoculars, and I could see somebody in a window upstairs. And I knew it couldn't be Frenchmen. They wouldn't be staring out of a window, I'm sure. Well, you never know. So I turned one of the guns on it and blasted the house. Sure enough, found a dead artillery officer and a signaler later. And the firing did stop. So maybe we got the right.
What was the initial reaction of the French towards the Canadians and all the Allied forces?
The immediate reaction was one of, "Thank God you're here." And we would say, "Well, look at your homes we've ruined. Think that doesn't matter. We can build new ones." We did later on find a few who were a bit bitter about the damage, thinking that it wasn't necessary. But when there are Germans in the buildings, what else can you do? And they agreed with reason, of course. I think on the whole, they're very pleased to see us, although I must admit that the Germans had left most people on the coast that they could pretty well trust, or who could feed them, because they were farmers, you see, majority of them. They pushed the other people out who were mainly tourists, that ran tourist places and things like that, or who commuted to Rouen and Paris and places to work. So there were very few left. Bernier-sur-Mer had a population of about 900. Peacetime today it has a population of about 900. It's still a seaside resort, beautiful today.
What was the next big action you saw, the Flays and Flays
Pocket? Caen first, where we lost a lot of men there and direct hits on our guns, in a place called Hell's Corners, which is in the north suburbs of Caen. But next we went to a place called Cobecourt, deployed our guns around Cobecourt, or Cobecourt, I suppose, in French, on the main road from Caen to Falaise, on the 14th of August, we had just gone back into action with our 25-pounders, and having given up the 105s because the Americans wouldn't give us any more ammunition to fire the 105s. So we're back to 25-pounders, and we're quite happy about this. They're much easier to maneuver. And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I think it was, our own Air Force came over and drove in support of the ground troops. And this is the first close support by bombers in the war. And it had no ground-to-air communication, apparently. And they started dropping their bombs behind us. And I happened to be talking to the adjutant on the phone, who was in a farmhouse in Kovikor, and told him that he'd better get underground somehow, because there are bombs coming down. He laughed and said, "Oh, sure." And he said, "Oh, you're right, here they come." Well, they didn't hit that farmhouse, fortunately. But on the other side of the road, the 12th Field Regiment was hit, and they lost a lot of men and guns. And they were running across our gun position. In the meantime, I evacuated the whole gun position, stopped firing, and evacuated all our men to the to our left, which would be to the east, and told them to go as far as they could away from the bombing. But the bombing seemed more to our right than, and on us than to the left. And so they did that. I kept my signaler there. Oh, I tried to get him to go, and he refused. He had just lost his brother killed in another position before that, and he insisted on staying with the regiment. And he insisted on setting up the wireless set for the earphones on, and but he finally, it was too much for him, and we had to send him away for some help, psychiatric help, and he finally came back to us, and he was okay. Still alive today. Fine. But I noticed that there was a lot of black smoke coming up from where our wagon lines were, where we kept our guns, our vehicles of all sorts, and spare ammunition and food and so on and so forth. So I jumped in the Jeep. I had a Jeep and a half track there, and I jumped in the Jeep and drove over, and all our vehicles were gone, bombed. The Poles who were in reserve in their Polish regiment, our division, had their tanks there, and they were very badly hit. And our men had all run and gone into trenches, so we didn't lose any men there, not even wounded. However, the Poles weren't so well off, and they started bombing again while I was there. And one bomb landed beside a Polish tank, Sherman tank, and it threw the man out of the cockpit of the tank, and he landed on the ground. I went over to him, and he was dead. There wasn't a mark on him. It was a concussion, apparently. Then I went back to the gun position, and the men were starting to come back, and I saw this Jeep going up and down the road with a very high-ranking Air Force officer in it, RCAF, trying to stop them, and they sent a light aircraft up, and he was nosing around them like this, trying to signal to them that they were bombing our own troops. And I had put out the ground signals, yellow ground strips and K-strips, to tell the Air Force that they're our own troops. But we were also firing yellow smoke in our barrage we'd been firing, which meant that we were going to raise our fire and the infantry could move forward. But so putting yellow canisters of smoke off of the opposition didn't mean a thing to the Air Force or the yellow K-strips. So it really wasn't, what else could they do? There were two landmarks that they got confused with, I guess. And they're both the same, on the same highway. I think it was a gravel pit, two gravel pits. And actually the troops up forward were better off than we were back there.
Wasn't there a system where at the very front, ahead of the front line, there would be some sort of marker so the planes would know that was the front line and not to bomb in front of that? Or was that later?
That was later, yes. But our yellow smoke was supposed to be a signal that those were our troops down there because it was the end of our firing, you see. But as I say, they got mixed up with the other yellow smoke.
Your Batman wrote a song about that, or a
yes,
poem?
Yes, he wrote a poem about the way we were bombed. the 14th of August, and as he said, how dreadful it was, and how much fear there was of it all. He was a Welshman who had gone to the United States to live with his aunt, ran across the border into Canada and joined up at the beginning of the war, and quite a singer. And he really enjoyed writing all these songs. This one wasn't a very happy one, but very descriptive.
Okay, I guess we should follow your path through Northwest Europe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Describe the highlights or the events you most remember.
Yes, we moved several times, of course, down to Falaise, and then moved to the north towards Abbeville. After the capture of Abbeville, we went on to contain Boulogne, and while we were there, there was a truce made to evacuate the civilians from Boulogne because the German commander there refused to give up, and although he was given the opportunity, he wouldn't surrender. So we had the truce, and we sent our trucks in. A lot of ours went too, and picked up civilians and brought them in, and some of them came to where our gun position was, which was on a farm, so we had a chance to talk to them about what it was like being in Boulogne and being bombed and strafed and so on, and shelled. And it finally fell, and then we went to Cap Grenet, where the huge coast defense guns had been firing across at Dover, across the English Channel. And it was absolutely fantastic to see the size of these guns. You could stick your head down the barrel and there was lots of room left. And these automatic hoists to bring the ammunition up and push it into the gun, so on. We lost quite a few people during that attack because there were so many mines in the ground around that. We lost one observation post group, except the officer himself, who happened to be walking with the infantry with a walkie-talkie instead of a big wireless set. And then we deployed around Calais, and it finally fell. And this is where we first encountered a lot of water. The Germans had broken the dike walls on that land. It had been reclaimed land, you see. So we were in mud and water, and had quite an experience trying to winch guns in and out. Not too much happened there until we were... One particular thing that happened when we were moving north, we were moving as a division, and the second division was moving up behind us. And we were on this road at night. We had moved in the daytime, we were also moving at night, and all of a sudden we heard these German aircraft overhead. You could always tell them because they had unsynchronized motors. And they made a sound, and ours were synchronized, and you could really tell the difference. So we thought, oh well, they can't find us. Then down came some flares, and lit up the whole road and everything around. So we finally got orders to get off the highway as quickly as possible and hide under trees. So we did move. In the meantime, they were bombing the highway. We got into the camp, and not a camp, a farm, and told the men to scatter. So they scattered, and they one bomber came over and dropped its stick, and it was coming towards us on the other side of a farmhouse. So the men, some of the men that were in my vehicle, ran towards the some orchards across the street. One of them was running with his head down as hard as he could go. He ran into a brick wall, knocked himself out, just stayed there. And the rest of them climbed over the wall, and one of them was gone for 2 days, and he found us again. And the chap who had concussion was okay later on, after banging his head on the stone wall, brick wall. We didn't lose anybody or anything, any of the vehicles or guns that particular time. We were very lucky. So some of the other regiments did lose a little bit. So we went on, and we finally, when we crossed the Seine River near Rouen, we were deployed in a heavy wood that had a large cleared area in the middle, and we had our guns there. And we couldn't cross over at Rouen itself, the bridges were knocked out. So the infantry put the engineers, put a bridge across, a Bailey Bridge, across at Elbeuf. And so we were told to cross over at midnight. We couldn't see a thing in the woods, we had to walk through the woods. So I used a cigarette and led the battery with a cigarette behind me. Two cigarettes, one just lit and the other one burning. And followed all the way out of this wood to the bridge and crossed over. And we were to go on to a gun position on the far side about 5 miles further on. And we went into a sunken road and it was muddy. And the guns got mired down on this road. And I was at the end of the convoy this time in a half track. So I went around the other way to try to help winch them out the other end. Because it was a shortcut we'd taken, and we'd been told to take that route. So we went roaring down the road in half track, and all of a sudden we heard machine gun fire and bullets going on the side of the half track. So we put down the metal thing that goes down over the windshield, and the driver was looking through the little thing, little slit, and went as fast as this thing would go, which I think was about 35 or 40 miles an hour, and it just seemed as though it was crawling. We discovered later that we had gone, the reason we were told to go the other route, because that ground was still held by the Germans, but not in great number, fortunately. So we got through to the other end, and one of our officers had fallen asleep, squatting on the ground while they were winching them out. When the guns came out, he still had his vehicle was still there, but he was asleep. And finally, he got out, came, and didn't know where the guns had gone. So he got on the wireless and asked how to get to the gun position. So I got on and told him, "Can you see a church?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, go to the church, turn left, follow it, and we'll meet you." And the colonel came on and said, "Do not discuss things on the wireless. We have to fire guns." So I went back and said, "We haven't got any guns to fire." I shouldn't have done, of course. Anyway, then we didn't have any on the ground at all. They're all en route, because we're the only battery on that side of the river. And finally the guns came in and we fired, and the colonel never said a word later, fortunately. But he was right, of course. You're not supposed to hog the wire, the air. Where did we go from there? We moved into Belgium this time, and as an advance party we went to Maldegem, or Maldegem as we called it, and in Belgium, south of the Leopold Canal. And as you probably know, the Scheldt estuary is divided up into Dutch and Belgian territory, and just north of the Leopold Canal is part of Holland, but it's separated completely by the Scheldt River from the rest of Holland. And we were to go up into that area, but still south of the Leopold Canal. And we went into Maldegem and stopped at a pub for a beer. We went in and they wouldn't serve us. And we asked them why not, and they said, "The Germans are coming back." We said, "How do you know?" And they said, "Well, they told us they would." And we said, "Well, they're not coming back. We're not going to let them." And they said, "How do we know that?" All this in very broken French. And anyway, we finally got some beer and we went on our way. But we discovered later that Maldegem had been settled by Germans after the First World War. And of course, they were all pro-German. And there, you know about a fifth columnist. Well, they apparently were possibly made up some of the fifth columnists at this stage, where they were stringing wires across the road at the height of a motorcyclist's neck and the height of people driving jeeps. They usually had this windshield down, and they were catching them in the neck and killing them. So we were very cautious from then on and sent word around about that. So we deployed at a place called Caprica. And finally, eventually moved across into the Shaw Estuary by means of waterborne invasion from Caen up through the Caen Canal to Waterfleet, and then captured some land, and then we were able to go over a bridge made again by the engineer, the Bailey Bridge. And we took that area, but my, there was nothing much left of any of the villages and towns. They were really wiped out because you couldn't dig in because it was all below sea level. And the Germans were in the houses and what other buildings were available. So we fired at them and they fired back at us at the buildings and so on. It was a very, very bad area of fighting. A lot of casualties there. We went to, from there up to, by this time the whole of Belgium had been liberated. So we were taken to Ghent for a rest of about 5 or 6 days. And so we were billeted in different houses throughout the city, the whole division, about 18 to 20,000 people. Fantastic. And they were very, very friendly and very helpful. And we had food that we hadn't seen since we left Canada. Beautiful food. Belgium had been under a military government, and they didn't care about the civilians. They just let them do as they pleased. Whereas in Holland, they had a civilian government under Seyss Inquart. And it was a civilian government, and very, very bad for the civilians. So we really had a nice rest there, and a very good time. And then we moved to Nijmegen, where we relieved the British artillery and the American airborne troops. And our guns were deployed in a wood called Decker's Wald. And the regimental headquarters was in the former TB sanatorium in the woods there. And we had our guns deployed nearby in an offensive position. In other words, you're ready to attack. And we sat there from the 10th of November until late, almost the 20th of December. We moved into Nijmegen into a defensive role because we weren't going to attack. And we were too close to the enemy's firepower at the front. This is where I had a great experience with observation posts with the infantry. And one of them was in a